Welcome or welcome back to Horse for Whore. I'm Mariah.
And I'm Kayla.
And this week we are going to talk about Christina Boyer.
Okay. Never heard.
I think you'll like this one. I do just want to give a quick trigger warning. This is obviously Horse for Whore, so we cover some pretty messed up shit, but this does feature the death of a child, so if this isn't your jam, completely understand, just skip it and move on.
Yep, but we know the audience that we have.
Yeah, but also there is some paranormal, so.
Ooh, okay.
Okay, here we go. Devilry of the kind necessary to kill a toddler had to be punished swiftly. That is how Sue Horn remembered the public outcry about a murder that still haunted Carroll County, Georgia, nearly 30 years after it happened. Sue was a publisher and editor-in-chief of a local newspaper named Star News. She explained, quote, "Nothing like this ever happens in Carroll County. This was the biggest story it had ever seen," end quote. One day in the spring of 1992, a 3-year-old girl was brought to the local hospital where she was pronounced dead. Objectively, her body was cold, blue, and covered in bruises.
Oh.
Her name was Amber, and her young mother had a checkered past, and the two were new in town. Most residents of Carroll County are homegrown, and they often view outsiders with suspicion.
Little small town.
Yep, all those rumors swirl. And it didn't take long for the locals to blame Amber's mother, 22-year-old Christina Boyer, for the little girl's death.
That's kind of rude.
Yeah. And Carroll County is considered deep in the Bible Belt, and people saw Christina as the embodiment of everything they claimed to despise. She was unwed, abusive, sexually promiscuous, and ungodly.
She is a whore, they said. That's a small town vibe, though.
Yeah, yep, not wrong.
That's a small town Bible Belt vibe.
So Christina was born in 1969, and sadly, she was quickly turned over to the state. She was placed in long-term foster care with John and Joan Resch, a couple who had taken in hundreds of children in Columbus. Eventually, they adopted Christina, who at the time was known as Tina. And according to Christina, times were really hard for her. The household was hectic and the rules were extremely severe. According to her, one of her adopted brothers began molesting her when she was just 12, but she was too afraid to tell them.
That is so sad. That's so fucked up.
And she later wrote in a letter to a friend, quote, "Finally, I did tell them, but they didn't believe me and slapped my face," end right. quote. Yay. So just like total bullshit.
Yep.
When Christina was 14, the family began to notice something peculiar about her. It seemed that Christina could move physical objects with her mind.
What?
It started with a plate, a curtain, some chairs around the kitchen table.
What?
Things began to move when Christina became angry.
Ooh.
So the Reaches, of course, were religious, and they thought this was the work of a sinister force.
She's the devil.
Joan called the local reporter and that she knew, like she had a relationship with that reporter, and she asked if he could find someone to help.
Like a priest?
I don't know if that was what she wanted, but he did bring over a photographer.
Okay.
So... But this is actually kind of cool. So during this time, the film The Poltergeist was a recent hit. So Americans were, like, obsessed with telekinesis and, like, haunted children. So they were just there trying to capture it. But after a few hours, nothing happened. And then all of a sudden, a phone appeared to levitate off of the side table and fly across the room over Christina's lap. And it's actually caught on camera, which let me go find it for you.
And what year was this that they...
Oh, she was 14. Let me see. She was 14 and she was born in 1969. You do math. And we'll post this on our Instagram for everyone to see.
1983?
Yeah, isn't it weird?
That's wild.
Yeah.
It's not like they could just throw it and then take a picture too.
I know.
Back then, like, I don't think that they would have gotten like
a good
like shutter speed and stuff, so.
Or they at least like wouldn't have like, you know, great the cameras
tech. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Eventually, Christina's alleged capabilities were picked up across the country, and she was dubbed the Columbus Poltergeist Kid.
Okay.
Predictably, this drew the attention of paranormal researchers. A journalist whose name was Staza Edwards wrote years later, quote, "The Riesch House was a circus. Media, magicians, and psychokinetic investigators were keen to test Tina's powers, to pay witness to a shadowy poltergeist," end quote. So apparently, cameras and audio recorders were kept rolling in near constant hope of catching the unexplainable. Eventually, though, a reporter saw Tina knock over a lamp when she thought no one was looking.
Oh.
Yeah. It went crashing to the floor, and she looked up at all the adults for approval. And eventually, the news crews left, because, like, a hoax isn't intriguing, you know?
Yeah. So she was acting out then.
Yeah.
So she was treated poorly, and then when they thought she had, like, paranormal powers.
She was treated nice, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's sad.
I know. But her adopted mother still insists that the previous incidents had been real. Like, even the phone had, like, Tina hadn't done that. By Tina's account, she didn't know what to think at this time. Kids at the school hummed the theme to the Twilight Zone when she walked by. Some of them avoided her. Some of them thought she was the real deal. Like, she was just kind of being toyed with this whole time.
Wait. I have a question. Is this, like, the story that, like, prompted Carrie?
No.
Oh, okay.
Damn. Wow, we should do that one, though. But still, one stranger was drawn to Christina. His name was Bill Roll, and he believed that she was the real deal. He was what they call a parapsychologist, and that is a member of a small field of researchers who study the paranormal phenomenon. But obviously, like, their work is considered pseudoscience.
Yeah.
And according to Bill, what Tina presented was rare, and he described it, quote, as the destructive powers of thwarted emotions.
Okay.
Eventually, Bill moved into the Riesch's home so that he could interview Tina extensively. He taped her every move and sound with a camcorder, following her around. He made extensive notes of, quote, disturbances, end quote, as well as her physical and emotional state before, during, and after these disturbances happened. He later wrote that Christina presented, quote, one of the most convincing cases of poltergeist activity he had ever seen. And by Bill's account, the Riesches were at their wits' end with Christina. Whatever was happening with her was wreaking havoc on their family as a whole. Bill wrote in his 2004 book, quote, "I thought I might have a solution that would appeal to everyone," end quote. Eventually, and this is all in good faith, Bill convinced the Riesches to let him take Tina to North Carolina to be with his other group of researchers.
What?
Yeah, so she was actually introduced to someone named Jeannie Lagle, who was a psychiatrist and a hypnotherapist. And during their time, basically, Jeannie and Bill studied Christina, and they, like, scanned her brain, took her to therapists. They even, like, went to conferences talking about, like, paranormal psychology and stuff.
Okay.
Christina basically said that this was one of the best time of her life. Like, she was overjoyed by the attention, and she later recalled, quote, "My adopted father had stopped speaking to me, and my adopted mother and I argued all the time. Bill was like someone who was saving me from drowning in my family," end quote.
Good, 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 good.
Yeah, so when I first read that, I was like, hold up. Mm-hmm. Who took this baby girl where?
Right, I thought it was going to be, like, bad, but okay. I'm glad that someone got her away from there.
But eventually, Christina and her family, like, mended their relationships, basically. Mm-hmm. And they asked that she return to Ohio, and she did. Not long after moving back, Christina was 16, and she got married to a man named James Bennett. According to letters that she wrote, though, he was frequently abusive, and on multiple occasions, he bound, gagged, and raped Christina. And then beat her unconscious.
Stand-up guy.
One time he did burn her clothes, like all of her clothes, to keep her from leaving him. And she jumped from a second-story window and ran through the snow barefoot, wearing only shoes or like shorts and a t-shirt.
What the fuck?
And James tracked her down and brought her right back home.
Great.
Eventually, right. Christina became pregnant, and she gave birth to Amber on September 29th in 1988. And Christina was a good mom. Like, she gave Amber the childhood that she never had. Christina later said, quote, "I wanted Amber more than anything in the world. That's all I ever wanted was a child of mine, and I didn't want to give her up because I didn't want her to grow up like I did, thinking, you know, what's wrong with me that my parents didn't love me, didn't want me, didn't even try to raise me. And I felt like, you know, things might not be easy, but at least she would know that I loved her," end quote.
That's so sad.
I know.
She was so let down in her childhood.
Oh, it's gonna get worse, girl.
Oh, good. That's great.
Eventually, Christina did escape, and by no surprise, James continued to stalk, threaten, and even harass her. He refused to sign divorce papers with her. He called the electric company to cancel the electricity in her home, and he made multiple reports to the children's services.
Of course he did. That's too much energy. Like, take that energy and focus on yourself, because you need some help, dude.
Agreed. Agreed. That's the best advice he could hear.
True.
Christina stated, quote, "People say, why didn't you leave him? I did, but he stalked me and my parents and threatened us all," end quote.
Yeah, don't be victim blaming.
Yeah, she's like, she is the epitome of a victim of domestic abuse. And then she was completely failed by the system, and we're going to get into that.
Oh, good.
In 1990, Christina actually obtained a divorce from James, and she married Larry Boyer, which is where we get the name Christina Boyer from.
Okay.
And she had Amber at this time, obviously, so Larry was the stepdad. After several months of living together and being married, though, Larry started to beat Christina. She swears that he never hit Amber, but she worried that he might eventually, which is completely fair. That's logical.
Probably.
A social worker actually told Christina, like, hey, if you don't leave this abusive relationship, the state of Ohio will likely take your child.
Yep.
And so one night after Larry physically beat Christina and he was taken to jail, she fled with Amber in one arm and a suitcase in other, and she hopped on a bus to Carroll County, Georgia, to begin a new life.
Good.
And so Christina chose this location because it was close to Jeannie and Bill.
Oh.
Yeah, so both of them lived in the area. They were kind of like a duo, Jeannie and Bill were. And they like presented at conferences together, wrote books together. So they were like a pair of researchers.
And those were the two that took her away from like.
When she was young.
Yes. Okay,
Yeah.
good. Good. That's really cute. That's sweet.
Jeannie and Bill offered to support Christina as she tried to rebuild her life in Georgia. In an interview, Christina stated, quote, "When I moved to Carrollton, I felt between a rock and a hard place because I really didn't have a safe place to go with Amber. Carrollton was a safe space. I really wanted to come down and get away from everything, and I really thought we could make a new start," end quote. Christina found her own apartment in the local public housing complex. She got signed up for food stamps, and she explained, quote, "I was actually really proud of myself. I was making on my own for the most part. I'd gotten us away from my ex-husband, and I was making it. I'd begun to take parenting classes at the local college and began classes to brush up on my math skills. I thought I was doing all right," end quote. But Christina still struggled to find a job in Carrollton, which, like, I'm pretty sure that unemployment, like, is a common thing in the South. And so I can't imagine that it's great in the 90s if it's not great now. So she would work the odd jobs, but then she would also make a little bit of money actually transcribing notes for Jeannie. And she obviously wanted, like, a more secure job. Christina actually has a really good quote about this, and she explains, quote, "You know, it's hard to find a job. I didn't want to be on welfare, but I didn't have a choice. I couldn't get a job because I didn't have a babysitter, and I couldn't pay for a babysitter because I didn't have a job. And I don't have a job because I don't have a car, and I can't get freaking anywhere to get a job. Once you get caught in the cycle, you're just caught," end quote. When the holidays rolled around in December of 1991, Christina started to worry about food, her finances, and the possibility of eviction. She said, quote, "My welfare check didn't come through, and neither did the food stamps. I couldn't pay my rent, even though it was a low budget place, nor could I pay the utilities or buy food," end
Why didn't they
quote.
come in?
I know, I don't know. Maybe because it was like it got delayed because of the weather, but still, like, that's no excuse, you know?
Yeah,
Like, come
seriously.
on, government.
Get it together.
Christina, though, obviously still wanted Amber to have a present to open on Christmas morning, so she actually called into the local Carol radio station to enter Amber in as a participant of the Christmas Wish program, which, like, that's totally normal. I had one of those in our where we live too. In 1992, Christina started to date a local man named David Heron. They did maintain separate homes. Like, David had his own trailer, and Christina still had her apartment, obviously, but they still spent a lot of time together. David had a daughter around the same age as Amber, and the two would often play together. And not too long after they started dating, Christina began to leave Amber with David so that she could work during the day because David was working at night. So it was like she had a babysitter so she could get, like, work, you know? Christina and Jeannie both described Amber as a hyperactive child. Christina recalled that Amber often had toddler injuries, scrapes from sidewalk falls, bruises from falling off the bicycle. And Christina said she often remembered that, or she often reminded David that Amber and his child were very different kids. Like, while his daughter could sit alone and quietly color, Amber needed to be watched because she was so much more, like, rambunctious. In the days leading up to Amber's death, Christina began to notice that Amber was coming back with more and more bruises, facial swelling, and kind of like cuts on her cheek after being in David's care.
Suspicious.
I agree. And so did Christina. So she began to ask David, like, hey, what the fuck's going on, you know? And he would explain that Amber had tripped off of the curb or she'd fallen down the porch steps.
But wouldn't you like say that to the mom anyway? Like, wouldn't you be like, hey, by the way, like this is what happened. I took care of her. Like, it's fine.
She has a bruise because this, you know?
Yeah, like, why would you just not say anything? And then when she asks, you're like, oh, yeah, it's just, you know, kids being kids. Like, hello? She's three.
Yeah. And so Christina was kind of, like, alarmed by that. And so she asked Amber, hey, what happened? And Amber said, oh, you know, I fell, blah, blah, blah. And basically, like, confirmed the story that David did, which that doesn't say anything, but...
Yeah.
I guess that her bruising was actually so bad, though, that Christina and David actually discussed about taking Amber to the hospital.
What?
Yeah. And so Christina recalled at trial that David was telling her that if they took Amber to the hospital, there is a chance that Children's Services could take her away. Which, yeah, which is fair. Like, they could, you know? And Christina was scared of that.
Yeah, but if something is happening to...
I know. It's hard. And Christina spoke with Jeannie and Joan, her adopted mother, about Amber's bruising. And they actually, like, she asked them what they thought that she should do.
Yeah.
And both of the women agreed separately that Christina should monitor Amber and that if she starts to exhibit any concussion-like symptoms, such as, like, vomiting, nausea, then take her to the doctor immediately.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty sound advice.
That's fair. Yeah, that sounds like... I can just recall so many times where I'm like, yeah, I probably should have gone to the hospital, but my parents were like, no, 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 we'll just watch her. If everything's fine, like, whatever, you know?
And also, like, it's expensive to go to the hospital, and she's already struggling for money, like...
I understand
it. If it turns out to be nothing, yeah, then, like, that's money that could have fed her daughter.
And it's probably been nothing, like, the 15 times before this incident, you know? Yeah, so they're not thinking, like, oh, could this be the one time she has a concussion, you know?
Yeah.
So on the morning of Tuesday, April 14th, 1992, Christina and Amber were over at David's trailer. David had left early that morning, allegedly to go to the unemployment office because he'd actually lost his job the previous Friday.
Why?
I don't know. They didn't say why. Okay. Or I guess let me say, I didn't research why. True. Christina fed Amber and David's child, and David returned while Christina was getting ready for the day in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. Around 12:30, Christina actually took David's car to go to Jeannie's so she could transcribe some notes and earn a little bit of money. You know, it's April 12th, so Easter was right around the corner, and I guess Christina was working to purchase Amber new shoes and hair ribbons to match a pink dress that Joan had sent her from Ohio.
Aw, that's sweet.
So after about 6 hours of work, Christina got in the car to leave, and as she was pulling out of the driveway... Unbeknownst to her, Jeannie received a phone call, and it was David. He said, quote, I can't get Amber up. Jeannie was assuming. Wait,
but like, as she's pulling out of the driveway?
Yeah. And so Jeannie was like, oh, maybe he's overthinking or he's like embellishing. And so she just said, hey, Christina's on her way home. She's going to handle it when she gets there.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. So Christina didn't even know that David called yet.
Okay.
But when Christina arrived at the trailer, she saw that David was standing outside. As Christina got out of the car, he told her that he couldn't wake Amber up from her nap. According to Christina, she ran inside and found Amber unconscious. Christina immediately grabbed her daughter and rushed with David to the hospital. David drove while Christina attempted to perform CPR on Amber in the backseat.
That's sad.
On their way to the hospital, allegedly, the two stopped briefly at a roadside payphone to call Jeannie and ask her to meet them at the hospital.
Okay.
When they, and like, by all accounts, Jeannie was the person that Christina called anytime something was going wrong. And I can see that, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
When they pulled up to the emergency room entrance, and before David had even stopped the car, Christina, like, jumped out and sprinted inside screaming, my baby isn't breathing. A nurse ran over and placed Amber on a stroller and wheeled her into the operating room. Once Amber was taken away, she obviously broke down and began shouting at David, asking him what happened.
Yeah.
But according to Christina, he just kept saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Just like a few hours later, the nurses actually emerged from the operating room and had to inform Christina that Amber had passed away.
Aww.
Yeah, and the hospital staff actually noticed Amber had bruising on her face and body, so they called the police and child services, as they should have.
Mm-hmm. Protocol, like, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't do anything wrong.
Yeah.
The police arrested David on the spot, as he was the last person to see Amber, and Christina was taken in for questioning.
How long after, like, this whole trip and fall incident was this?
It's like 3 days after.
Okay, so it could be a result of that incident.
Well, or they'll talk about that at trial.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Could be that, or there could be a new thing that happened.
Yeah.
So around 10 p.m. on the day that Amber died, a detective assigned to the case sat down with Christina and interviewed her for over 11 hours.
That's a really long time.
Her interview was not recorded, and a detective took notes by hand.
I bet.
Christina explained, quote, "I was never taped or recorded. Years later, they would claim I said this or that, but they conveniently don't have a taped recording of that entire night with me," end quote. According to the notes, the detective asked Christina about Amber's bruising, which appeared to be significant. Mm-hmm. Which, like, obviously, they called the fucking police, so it was so bad. Mm-hmm. Christina explained that Amber had fallen several times in the days leading up to her death. According to Christina, the officers also asked seemingly unrelated questions about her personal life, including if she and David ever engaged in anal sex.
Why is that relevant?
They also asked if David was sexually abusive towards Amber or if Christina had ever allowed him to molest Amber.
Why would she do that?
Christina began to ask if she needed a lawyer, but the police told her, no, no, don't worry. They told her that they believed David had murdered Amber, and at several points they told Christina that they believed she was protecting David by refusing to acknowledge that David killed Amber, because Christina wouldn't, like, speculate at all, which is, like,
she shouldn't.
Good idea, yeah.
You should not. This, okay, so ridiculous.
Later that night, the officers accompanied Christina back to her apartment to investigate further, even though they'd been staying at David's trailer. The police, after their investigation, brought Christina back to the station, and it was only then that they read her Miranda rights and asked her to, quote, sign papers.
Probably not.
Christina, again, asked if she was in trouble or... like, hey, do I need a lawyer here? And the police assured her that it was, quote, part of the procedure.
If they're reading you your rights, you need a lawyer.
Yeah.
You just need a lawyer anyway.
Anyway, yeah, just say, I need a lawyer, and don't say another word.
Am I free to leave?
Yeah, if they say no, you just say lawyer.
Yep, and if they say yes, so you get up and walk out.
So, meanwhile, in a different room, three detectives and one social worker were questioning David. David's interview, however, was taped and transcribed.
I'll bet.
At times, the detectives seemed to indicate that they were on David's side, telling him that they thought he was, quote, the type of person who would have helped a child in distress. And they reassured him that they understood his fears about taking Amber to the doctor.
Yeah, but that could just be a tactic. They might not actually believe that.
Oh, yeah. I think that that's probably right. But also throughout the interview, the detectives repeatedly insisted that Amber had been sodomized based on word of mouth of the hospital staff.
What?
And so eventually, the police coerced a confession out of David that he had sexually abused her, despite the fact that her autopsy later demonstrated no evidence of sexual abuse.
So where did that come from?
I know, and the detectives were telling him that he would face a more lenient sentence if he confessed to sexual abuse, while Christina would then be charged with murder.
What? Okay, the stories that they craft are so... You should have been a screenwriter, honestly.
David and both Christina repeatedly reiterated that they were the only adults with Amber on all of the days leading up to her death. So, like, that no one else would have done this. This sincerely, they think, is like a freak accident, is what they're saying. David openly admitted that many of the bruises on Amber's face and forehead had occurred while she was under his care.
Yeah.
But he insisted that he never spanked her. That he never beat her aside from a very rare spanking.
Mm-hmm.
He said that Christina spanked Amber as well, though she did it more regularly when she became frustrated with Amber. However, David did not see Christina hit or spank her in the 4 days leading up to her death.
Okay.
There was one direct contradiction to Christina's story, though. David insisted that he was the one, not Christina, who brought up the conversation about taking Amber to the doctor.
Okay.
And David said that Christina was the one who voiced concerns that the Child Protective Services would take Amber away. So he was like, oh, I'm the good guy, you know.
But even then, like, even if that version is true, her concerns are valid.
Yeah.
She's struggling to keep her daughter and, like, give her a really good life.
Fortunately, though, a woman named Susan, who was a CPS worker, and she'd assisted Christina on moving from Ohio to Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And she was in the interview with David, I should say. She was the one social worker. She told David and detectives during the interview, quote, I have trouble believing Christina would feel like we'd take the baby away from her. We've never indicated that. CPS has been very helpful and a good resource for her in the past, end quote.
Yeah, that's true.
Eventually, despite having briefly agreed to the unfounded, you know, admit to sodomy and she'll be charged with murder, David ended the interview by insisting that he'd never sodomized nor had he murdered Amber. And the sodomy allegations were never raised again, especially once, you know, the autopsy was like, hey, this hasn't happened.
So were they just fishing?
I think so. So the detective's investigation included searching both Christina's apartment and David's trailer. In Christina's apartment, they allegedly found a belt that they believed Christina used to beat Amber. The police did not find a belt in David's trailer where they had been staying the night before she died.
Okay.
They did take that belt from Christina's apartment to the medical examiner's office, and someone held it up next to one of the bruises on Amber's face and took a photo. This photo was actually later submitted into evidence at David's trial, despite having the belt not been tested for prints, DNA analysis was never conducted. They did no testing. They just thought, hey, this belt roughly matches the size and shape of one of the bruises. And that was supposed to be, like, you know, a big deal.
Damning evidence, yeah.
And so a medical examiner testified that a flexible object such as a belt could have caused trauma that killed Amber, but he couldn't say that for sure.
Yeah.
In both the kitchen and bathroom trash cans at David's trailer, the police found bloody tissues which matched Amber's blood type, which was O. David's blood type was recorded as A, and Christina's was never tested. David alleged that Amber used the I know. Why wouldn't they test her?
And the other kids. Like, what do you mean?
David said, though, that Amber used those tissues to wipe blood off of her chin and her lip because she'd, quote, reopened a cut in, like, on her mouth on the day of her death, which her autopsy does reveal that she has two cuts in her mouth, and they show fresh evidence of healing and then, like, splitting open. So that story checks out. The police obviously questioned acquaintances and local officials for character evidence against both Christina and David. The detectives created a packet of 42 statements, which would be introduced in pretrial hearings, allegedly constituting like basically evidence of why Christina should be sentenced to death for the murder of Amber, were these character statements.
Good.
The investigation stretched all the way back to Ohio, digging into the old CPS reports that were filed by Christina's ex-husband. Mm-hmm. Importantly, only three reports of child abuse were ever filed against Christina, and all three were investigated and dismissed because they were deemed unsubstantiated. So, like, not even cases that should be brought up because they're not real.
Yep. Her defense could have easily got that thrown out.
The detectives took down 20 separate statements as evidence of Christina's violence. Over half of these statements were made by her abusive ex-husband. Another incident involved an emergency room nurse claiming that Christina had burned Amber, but a doctor later correctly recognized this as staph infection and fixed, like, the medical notes.
Oh my God, okay.
Christina insists that the remaining statements were made by family members of a man whom Christina had called the police on for breaking into her apartment while he was drunk. Apparently, these family members lived in the same apartment complex as Christina, and they called CPS as a means of retaliation. Mm-hmm. However, like, after looking at all the records, I guess the CPS workers, they've never labeled them as unsubstantiated claims. Like, it just looks like they haven't investigated them.
Yeah.
And while nothing materialized from those claims, still it didn't look good, and their strikes against Christina's character. And so was her history with telekinesis, you know, like, that's like weird shit. And I guess in May of 1993, just a year over Amber's death, while Christina was, like, waiting for her trial, Unsolved Mysteries actually aired a segment about her.
Ooh.
But they didn't mention, like, the pending charges.
Hmm. Okay. Did that hurt her?
Yeah. Yeah, that being, like, associated with paranormal. And I think that just, like, changed, like, how people look at her.
Yeah.
And that sucks.
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of this just stems on people didn't think that Christina was morally okay, which, like, what the fuck does that even mean, you know?
Yeah.
Like, who cares? And Christina had a largely positive relationship with CPS in Carroll County. Like we discussed earlier, they helped her move. They signed her up for benefits. They helped her find her house. They're even, like, how she, like, started going to college classes. And she claimed that the majority of these statements collected to be, like, negative character witnesses were made after Amber's death, and they're from people who had reason to dislike her, who were trying to retaliate against her. Christina later wrote, quote, "There are suddenly a lot of people I've never met crawling out of the woodwork to say what a terrible mother I was."
Yeah, that tracks.
Yep.
They want their 15 minutes.
Yep. And the police ultimately charged David and Christina with murder and cruelty to children. In an interview, one of the detectives said, quote, "One of them had to do it. They were pointing at each other, but there are only two, so we charged them both," end quote. And also the police, like, justified it by saying, like, even if it was only one person that struck Amber, the other one is guilty of not bringing her to the hospital or calling 911.
Yeah, I don't think I agree with that, but
in jail, Christina insisted that Amber be buried in her new Easter dress.
Aw.
Christina was brought to the funeral home where she saw Amber in the casket, but she was actually handcuffed in her jail uniform and was kept, like, in a separate area.
That's ridiculous.
Eventually, Christina was indicted by a grand jury for murder, aggravated assault, and cruelty to children. She was accused of repeatedly hitting Amber in the head and the abdomen. And though her loved ones believed she was innocent, much of Carroll County did not.
Okay, well, the abdomen thing could just be her giving her daughter CPR in the car.
Yeah, yes. even if like ribs were broken, like I'm pretty sure that's supposed to happen.
Yes.
The residents were deeply shaken by Amber's death. One wrote in a letter to the editor of Star News, where Sue Horn worked at, quote, "My body felt numb as I tried to imagine the horror that this innocent child must have felt as her own mother allegedly participated in her cruel death and earned her cruel and violent death."
End quote. I realize that you put allegedly in there, but that is so damning. Like, stop doing that. Stop covering things that haven't gone to trial. There are so many cases that I want to, like do for the podcast, but they haven't gone to trial yet.
And yes.
I just do not agree with that.
And we have a guilty until proven innocent. Or, I'm sorry, hold on, let me change that.
That's exactly how it is.
That's what it is. It should be innocent until proven guilty. So, like, Gabby Petito, like, when people were covering her case, I'm like, it's really interesting, but, like, I don't want to say anything until there's a resolution, you know?
I know. That's why, like, literally I was following that, and then we had started the podcast already, and I was like, this would be such a good one to do. But, yeah. Like, still, I... And everyone was covering it at the time, too, before even knowing what was happening. Like, when Brian, like, whatever his last name is, was freaking missing. Like, people were covering it and, like, speculating that he did it and this and that. And I'm like, you're not waiting for evidence.
Yeah, just wait. And which he did do it, so.
Yeah, well.
Many people in Carroll County, following the story, thought that Christina had a guilty profile. It wasn't just that she was young, poor, unmarried, and an outsider, or that she'd been accused of abusing Amber. Police also knew that one of Christina's neighbors made sex tapes and paid women to participate. Christina appeared in one of them, dancing topless. In another video, she sat next to the neighbor on a couch while they watched porn together. Halfway through the scene, Amber actually toddles into the room wearing nothing but a diaper, and Christina jumps up and takes Amber into another room where she spanked her.
Oh.
In the lead up to her trial, all of this was made public, so before she's even gone to trial. Mm-hmm. So on top of all of her other perceived failings, Christina was labeled a slut.
Okay, well, she was trying to make money for her kid. And you've said it before, sex work is real.
It's work. Throughout this whole story, it's been undercurrents of, like, I have no money. Like, I can't get a job. So I completely sympathize with, like, fuck yeah. Like, I get that. Make your money, girl. Like, whatever.
Yeah.
I don't agree with, like, Amber being there during it. That's part that's really hard for me.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah. But, like, she didn't have a babysitter. Like.
Yeah.
And I don't agree with the whole, like, spanking her because she came into the room either. She's three. She doesn't understand.
No, yeah. And I'm, like, I'm fortunate enough to never have to be in this situation. Yeah. So it's hard for me to, like, judge her for being in this, like, what are you going to do? You're damned if you do, damned if you don't, you know?
I'm not judging her for any part of it, but I do disagree with, like, certain aspects of it.
And I can see how people, like, if you aren't following the case, that you're just, like, holy shit, like, oh my god, like, that's terrible. Like,
yeah, but also let's keep in mind it was the early 90s, like,
yeah,
there's just a lot of things that, like,
they don't understand that,
yeah,
like, that sex work was like, ugh, you know, ugh.
Anyway,
so Christina's lawyer was a court-appointed attorney from Marietta, Georgia, named Jimmy Berry.
Wow.
She remembered him telling her that he would take her case all the way, prove her innocence, and Christina was grateful.
But did he?
Well, according to his invoice, Jimmy visited Christina 4 times over the 2.5 years that she awaited trial.
That's it?
He logged 126 hours on the case, only 17 of which were for court preparation.
That's it?
The rest were for the time that he spent in front of a judge.
Huh?
So he didn't do shit. He just went in, like, delayed the trial till as far as possible, and then charged the state a total of over $6,000, almost $7,000.
Great. And I know that, like, court-appointed defense attorneys are completely overworked.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, here we go. So records show that at the time, Jimmy was actually working on a second high-profile death penalty case in Georgia where he was defending an attorney accused of hiring a hitman to murder his wife.
Mm.
According to Christina, Jimmy was hard to get a hold of. Sometimes she called him, she wrote him letters, and she never heard back. And she was also wondering why it was taking so long for her case to go to trial. So, like, she doesn't know that these delays are going on, that he's, like, stalling. Finally, Christina's trial was scheduled for October 31st, 1994. In the days leading up to it, Jimmy arranged for Christina to take a polygraph test, and she passed, which she thought was good news. Mm-hmm. But the next day, Jimmy came to see her and said that going to trial was a bad idea.
Oh, no.
Christina remembers the conversation, and he emphasized that even without clear-cut evidence against Christina for murdering her, the case against her was, like, just too strong in public opinion. With the prior accusations of abuse, the fact that she didn't take Amber to the hospital, like, when she was questioning it, her checkered past. Like, I don't believe all of those things, but I understand why someone would see that.
Did he not take, like, Jeannie and Jones, like, statements as character witnesses?
No.
Especially for, like, the time that she called and asked about, like, what she should do?
No, I don't think so.
Oh, my God.
Jimmy suggested that they actually consider taking the Alford plea, which you know what that is about, and I'm sure all of our listeners do, as it would keep her from receiving the death penalty.
Oh, that sucks.
Christina was completely alone with Jimmy when she accepted the plea. She remembers telling her, or she remembers him telling her friends who wanted to talk her out of the plea, saying that they were, quote, going to get her killed. Jeannie remembers not being able to see Christina before she took the plea, and she remembers Jimmy calling her and saying that if she convinced Christina to reject it, she was, quote, sending her friend to the electric chair. After sentencing, Jeannie allegedly encountered Barry in the parking lot, and he defended his strategy by saying, quote, Christina was a bad mother, and they had all this evidence that she just wasn't a good person anyway.
End I thought quote. He believed her.
I know.
He should have recused himself.
And I guess I didn't write about it, but I saw in a few sources that Jeannie theorized. So Jimmy was like a really high profile lawyer. He had no losses in death profile or like death penalty cases. And so it is possible that he thought, like, I'm not going to win this. And so she needs to take the Alford plea so she doesn't stain my reputation and my record.
Yep. That's so selfish. Like, just recuse yourself.
Yeah. On October 23rd, 1994, Christina Boyer turned just 25 years old. Mm. The next day, she was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years.
Plus 20.
The aggravated assault and then the murder, two separate. David's case went to trial in the spring of 1995, and Christina agreed to testify to her version of events. Mm-hmm. On cross-examination, David's defense attorney mocked Christina's alleged paranormal past and attempted to lay the blame on Christina for abusing Amber.
Okay.
Six witnesses, including David, testified that they'd all at some point seen Christina slap or drag Amber by the hair.
Oof.
Christina admitted that she had not been a perfect mother. She had spanked Amber. She'd often cussed at her, and that she had brought Amber to the home of the neighbor with whom she'd slept with because she had no money for food or rent. But she also denied the statements of severe physical abuse wholeheartedly.
Yeah.
She said that she'd never hit Amber with a belt, never beat Amber in the head, never hit Amber with a closed fist, and if she did spank Amber, she spanked the back of her legs below her underwear. In addition to character evidence, David's trial also introduced medical evidence into the timeline to which David and Christina both agreed to. When the medical examiner was asked if a lethal brain injury that could have occurred back as far as Friday, April 10th, so 4 days before Amber's death, could that have been the cause of her death? And that medical examiner responded, quote, "I doubt it. I really don't think so because Amber didn't really have a lot of brain swelling, which reaches a maximum of 48 to 72 hours after the injury," end quote.
Okay. So was it something else that happened?
Yeah. So he was saying that it was more likely that Amber received the fatal blow on the morning of the 14th when she was alone with David. However, the medical examiner stated, quote, "It's not impossible that the injuries were inflicted in the morning and she died that evening," end quote, allowing room for Christina to have basically,
yeah, so Christina or David, that day,
yeah,
either when she was with her mom or with David.
Yeah.
Okay.
Ultimately, the jury charged David with cruelty to children for failing to take Amber to the hospital in the days leading up to her death. David was sentenced to 20 years in prison.
But here's the thing. If we've determined that the Friday incident was not the cause of death, then why are we charging him and the mom with cruelty to children?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe because I think it's because they didn't take him to the hospital. And I think that the thought process was, if you have the thought that you should and you're asking people if you should, then you just should, which I don't really agree with.
That's a privileged viewpoint. Like, that's a financially privileged viewpoint.
Detective Mike Thomas said years later that the fact of Christina's guilty plea, even if it was an Alford plea, likely influenced David's jury. Yeah. He stated, quote, "Personally, I think if the jury hadn't known that Christina pled guilty to homicide, they would have found him guilty. If his jury hadn't known she'd pled guilty to murder, he would have gotten life."
Guilty.
Well, she took the Alford plea, but yeah, I know what you mean.
She pled no contest.
David was paroled in 2011.
Of course he was.
So Christina was denied parole in 1999, and on November 18th, 2002, Christina lost her state habeas case. In 2007, Christina's habeas attorney, J. Philip Carr, so that's basically when she's saying, like, hey, I'm appealing this because I got improper representation.
Yeah.
So she lost that case. 5 years later, her attorney was convicted of 6 counts of child molestation, 2 counts of statutory rape, and was sentenced to 40 years in prison. That same year, Christina was once again denied parole.
Okay, so...
Wait, don't look, don't read any spoilers.
I'm not reading okay, any good, spoilers. Okay. I'm just... So I was wondering, like, the Darlie Routier case, that's, like, one of the first female cases, and everyone, like, condemned her as well. And I know that that was in Texas, but I knew it was kind of around the same time, so I was wondering if, like, maybe some biases from that case had influenced this one, because they're both the South, but... I think that the Darlie Routier case was 96, so...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so this would have been before.
Yeah, yeah. That's just, you know, how I was trying to jump.
Maybe it, like, influenced her appeals and stuff, though. Or when she was going to the parole board, I bet it influenced it then, too.
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe this case influenced the Darlie Routier case.
Yeah. Not long after this parole denial, an attorney named Richard Allen got in touch with Christina because he believed she was innocent.
Why do I know that name?
I'm pretty sure he's pretty popular. He was straightforward, seemed honest and committed, and most importantly, he would take the case for free. Richard Allen, just like you and I, and probably all of our listeners, believed that public opinion had been Christina's undoing. What if people could see her differently, Richard thought.
Wait, I know why I know that name.
Why?
That's the man accused of killing the two girls in the Delphi case?
I think it's probably just the same name.
It's
the same name.
I'm sorry. It's not the same person. It is the same name. That's why I know that.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Sorry, that makes sense.
It's the same person. I'm just saying same name. That's crazy.
Yeah. That is crazy. Yeah. Oh. I was like, hold on. So a few days before Christmas in 2007, Richard walked into Sue Horn's office at the Star News. He quickly went into detail about Christina's case, all of which Sue, of course, knew about. And he suggested that maybe the paper could write about it if she wanted to look into it. So Sue agreed, saying that she would investigate, you know, further than the surface level that she'd done. And a few days later, she was actually reviewing all of the court documents during her family vacation. And she couldn't believe what she was reading. Everything that could have seemed to gone wrong for Christina did.
Yep.
And Sue, too, became convinced of Christina's innocence.
Oh, good. Okay.
On January 20th, 2008, she wrote a lengthy article in her paper under the headline, quote, "The Real Story of Christina Boyer. Did a Perfect Storm of Events Lead to a Life of Imprisonment?" Horn followed up the article with an op-ed, and she wrote, quote, "Believe me, I'm no tree-hugging, Bambi-loving, soft-hearted woman who's searching for a cause to make my life have meaning. I've got enough to do." Mm-hmm. Christina is serving a life sentence plus 20 years for the death of her 3-year-old daughter. Did she do it? Her lawyer told the judge no at hearing, but she sits in prison today. Christina had no family, few friends, and no money. But it's possible she can have justice. Read the story. Let me know. End quote. And the article barely even made a ripple in Carroll County.
Yeah.
Still, Richard Allen was preparing to petition on Christina's behalf. Then, one snowy day in March 2009, Richard had a heart attack and died suddenly. And the petition for Christina died along with him. In December of 2023, Christina's parole was rejected for the 9th time. Jesus. The argument was the same as on earlier occasions, quote, "insufficient amount of time served to date given the nature and circumstances of your offenses," end quote.
Where's the full evidence?
Yep. And on average, people convicted of murder serve 29 years before they're paroled. Christina, now 52, has been incarcerated for over 31 years.
Oh, okay. Insufficient time served. Yeah, okay.
Lie.
Yeah.
During her time in prison, Christina has provided support to her peers. She's kept herself busy. Not only does she volunteer to tutor her fellow students and practices her faith, but she's also working towards a bachelor degree, majoring in communications with a minor in business administration. Sue Horn explained that the continued bad luck in Christina's case, her patchy legal representation, which is not her fault, her status as an outsider, the fact of her paranormal past, and other evidentiary issues, such as having sex with a neighbor for work in the 90s, hurt her case. Sue believes that times and attitudes have shifted enough that the state of Georgia might eventually grant Christina 1 ounce of justice. Quote, "All of the things that took Christina down, her reputation, who she was, living with her boyfriend, the fact that she doesn't go to church, doesn't have friends, none of these things would apply today." And that is the story of Christina Boyer and the death of Amber Bennett.
Well, that was horribly depressing. Disgusting. And I'm very upset. So, like, what's going on today with it?
That's it. She was denied parole in December and she sits in prison.
Oh, there's a Hulu documentary.
Yeah. Oh, and also, I didn't cover this. Obviously, there's, like, so much that we could talk about, but there is a whole documentary that was created by, like, college kids in Stanford, I think. But no, it was a Georgia school. But nothing came out of it. Like, they basically made the documentary and graduated high college, so. So anyway, we love the justice system, but also they could do a lot more.
Yeah. Okay, well, there's a petition on that website.
Yeah, change.org.
It's a change.org one. They have like a little over 3,000 signatures and they need 5,000.
And there's a GoFundMe if you want to financially support Christina if you have the means. So we'll also link that.
Yeah.
But yeah, we suggest, if you agree, obviously it's your opinion, but I know that we're going to sign it. We're probably going to donate to her GoFundMe what we can spare in support of who we believe was wrongly incarcerated.
Yeah, I just signed the petition. I'll go donate. And the documentary is on Hulu called Demons and Saviors. So I just saved that to my list.
There we go. But yeah, we'll be back in 2 weeks with another one. No idea what it is yet, but hopefully it's not about children's deaths.
Oh, we should do a buffer episode. Yeah. Maybe
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll come up with one. But we'll see you then. Bye.
Okay, bye.